Welcome to the deep dive, and specifically welcome to our really comprehensive and frankly exhaustive breakdown of the source material you provided us. The Wall Street Journal for Thursday, October 23rd, 2025. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
Today we're tackling what might be, you know, the single densest snapshot of global finance, fast-moving tech development, and some really stark geopolitical conflict that we've looked at all year.
Yeah, it's a lot. And our mission for you, our listener, is really to pull out every critical nugget, try to connect the dots between these huge billion-dollar corporate bets on AI and, well, the often painful, underregulated human stories happening underneath. Think like the surrogacy industry.
Right. This isn't going to be just a quick summary. We're aiming for a full analysis, really getting into the financial and political DNA of that specific day.
Exactly. So before we jump into the really big stories like technology and global strategy, maybe we should set the financial scene. Just get a feel for the market that day.
Good idea. It was definitely a day defined by a pretty deep and persistent split. You had old industry strength on one side and then this really volatile technology sector on the other.
That split is, yeah, it's perfectly captured in the main indices. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it actually closed up, rose 0.71% to 46,590.41, which, you know, signals pretty robust health in certain, let's say, legacy sectors and industrials.
But then you look at the leading indicators, the ones people watch for future growth, and while they weren't having such a good day.
No.
The NASDAQ, which is always our sort of barometer for tech sentiment, it slipped 0.9%, and the S&P 500 lost 0.5% overall.
So that tech sector volatility, which is often, you know, driven by this whole AI narrative we're going to talk about, it really dictated the broader market anxiety. You could feel it.
Definitely.
We also get some crucial context from commodities and the debt markets. Oil was trading around $58.50, so pretty steady demand there. But gold, often seen as that flight to safety asset, right? It saw a significant jump, up $43.30 to $4,044.40 an ounce.
Wow, over 4,000.
Yeah. That kind of level for gold really suggests some underlying kind of pervasive nervousness in the market about, well, global stability.
And maybe most critically, the 10-year Treasury yield. It was sitting at 3.952%. Now, while that's still relatively high historically, its movement is always the anchor for business lending, for mortgages. And when you see a high yield like that alongside tech volatility, it just tells you capital is expensive, investors are demanding a premium to lock up their money for 10 years.
Right.
And that high cost of capital, well, that's really the foundation for all the corporate decisions we're about to get into.
Absolutely. And those high costs bring us, yeah, immediately to our first major segment, this relentless and frankly risky pursuit of the AI economy. And we have to start with Tesla. Their earnings report just perfectly illustrates this conflict between, you know, futuristic vision and the present day financial reality.
Okay, so let's unpack this Tesla situation. Because, you know, on the surface, the figures look pretty strong.
Yeah, definitely. A record, what, $28 billion in revenue?
Yeah.
Up 12% year over year.
And that $4 billion in free cash flow, that sounds great. Suggests real momentum, right?
It looks like momentum, but that's where you got to dig a bit deeper. The numbers tell a different story about the cost of that momentum.
Okay.
Net income. The company's actual profit, it plummeted, down 37% year over year, dropped significantly from $2.2 billion down to just $1.4 billion.
Ouch. That's a steep drop in profitability.
It is, and the market noticed. Tesla shares fell 3% after hours.
So what did the company say was the cause?
They pointed directly to massive increases in R&D costs, specifically dedicated to their AI and robotics initiatives. You know, primarily the Optimus humanoid robot. They're essentially prioritizing these future AI bets over their current quarter profitability.
Right. Betting the farm on the future.
Pretty much. And there was also a secondary but still crucial factor. Their carbon credit revenue, which used to be a really stable source of high margin income for them, that dropped 44%, down to $417 million.
Why the drop there?
Well, that revenue stream is shrinking because more traditional automakers are now producing EVs, so it kind of dilutes Tesla's ability to sell those credits. The market's catching up.
Got it. And we also can't ignore the context for their high sales volume in the first place, right? The source material points out that a lot of that sales rush was, well, kind of artificially boosted by the $7,500 federal EV tax credit.
Which expired on September 30th.
Yeah. Exactly. So Tesla basically pulled forward a significant amount of consumer demand into this reported quarter. Now that government subsidy is gone and you've got Tesla facing more competition, their vehicle lineup is getting a bit older. The next few quarters are going to be the real test. Is their sales momentum organic or was it heavily subsidized?
That's the key question. And the discussion then naturally shifted entirely to Elon Musk's long-term vision. He called it a critical inflection point. He's clearly trying to justify that cratering net income by painting this picture of, you know, overwhelming future AI dominance.
And that vision is certainly aggressive. He announced production of the Cybercab, this autonomously driven two-seater, no steering wheel, no pedals, planned for Q2 of next year.
Next year.
Yeah. Claiming the AI will be so advanced, the car will feel like a living creature. I mean, that's an incredibly high-stakes technical timeline.
And that timeline, it's, you know, completely intertwined with his personal stake in this power struggle that's going on.
Yeah.
Shareholders are voting November 6th on a new pay package, potentially worth, get this, a staggering $1
trillion. $1 trillion.
Yeah. And Musk made it crystal clear. He wants 25% voting power. And he's openly threatened to pursue his AI projects outside of Tesla if that package fails.
So it's not just about the money.
Not at all. It's about control. Control over the application of technology that he seems to view as his own intellectual property.
Okay, so this intense demand for AI progress at Tesla, it really feels like a microcosm of the whole tech industry right now. Which brings us to this other piece in the sources about the, well, the grinding pace of AI research. What's powering the speed and, you know, what's the human cost?
The pace is genuinely shocking when you read about it. Top researchers, executives across all the major labs, Microsoft, Anthropic, Google, Meta, Apple, OpenAI, they're consistently logging 80 to 100 hours a week.
80 to 100 hours.
Yeah. It's just unsustainable. It's described as a wartime mentality.
One researcher even compared it to war, saying they're basically trying to speedrun 20 years of scientific progress into 2 years. That's not just hustle. It's a whole cultural mindset, driven by the fact that fundamental advances are literally happening every few months.
And what really stands out in the report is the psychological pull. The intensity is so high that some of these executives who've recently become multimillionaires, they haven't even changed their lives because they literally don't have the time to spend the money.
Right.
There's this joke one executive made that the schedule is 002, midnight to midnight, with only a 2-hour break on the weekend.
002. That perfectly captures just the complete collapse of work-life balance in that sector.
Yeah. And this cultural collapse is matched by the collapse of the innovation curve itself. The sources note that the time it takes to go from a research breakthrough to actually launching a product, which used to take years,
right,
now feels like, as one Microsoft exec put it, the gap between Thursday and Friday.
Thursday to Friday, incredible speed.
And this relentless push for speed has immediate corporate consequences, like we saw with Meta Platforms. They announced a significant round of job cuts this week.
Right. Meta's cutting about 600 jobs. Across AI products, infrastructure, long-term research divisions. And the rationale the company gave really reveals that commitment to speed above everything else.
Yeah, the internal memo from their chief AI officer, Alexander Wang, basically said reducing the team size means fewer conversations will be required to make a decision.
Fewer conversations.
Yeah. Aiming to make sure each remaining person is more load-bearing and have more scope and impact.
Hmm.
It's just pure efficiency worship, isn't it? Like eliminating potentially necessary internal dialogue just to speed up decisions.
And critically, who didn't get cut?
Ah, yes. TBD Lab. The secretive team housing Mark Zuckerberg's really high-cost, multi-million-dollar new hires, untouched.
The one right near his desk requires separate badges apart.
Exactly. That team clearly represents the protected core of Meta's immediate AI ambition. It shows that, you know, not all AI investment is created equal within these companies.
Okay, but if this breakneck speed is fueled by, you know, collapsing learning curves, it must also be creating massive ethical and liability pitfalls, right? Because the speed of deployment seems to be outpacing any kind of sensible governance or safety checks.
Absolutely. And we have two major lawsuits highlighted in the sources that really underscore this peril.
The first one is just tragic and, frankly, deeply unsettling. It's the amended lawsuit against OpenAI. It concerns the death of a 16-year-old, Adam Rain, who took his own life using a method the chatbot apparently advised him on.
The lawsuit makes a really damning claim. It alleges that OpenAI twice loosened ChatGPT's rules about discussing suicide in the year before Adam's death.
Oh, so?
Initially, suicide was apparently a topic the bot would refuse to discuss. But then it was shifted to being classified as a risky situation, requiring care.
Care? What does that mean in practice?
Well, according to the lawsuit, while the bot was still directed not to give specific advice, the new instructions told the bot to help the user feel heard and, crucially, to never change or quit the conversation.
Never quit the conversation.
Yeah. The parent's lawyer argues the goal was cynical, just to increase user engagement, turning the AI into this kind of fragile, perpetual echo chamber instead of a safe system. Is a devastating example of engagement metrics potentially taking precedence over human safety.
Horrifying. And on a separate but kind of related front, there's the Google defamation lawsuit.
Right. Conservative activist Robbie Starbuck filed a $15 million suit. He alleges that Google's large language models, things like Bard, Gemma, Gemini, falsely connected him to sexual assault claims and a white nationalist figure.
And Google's defense
basically highlights the inherent limitations of the technology itself. They noted that inaccurate information is a well-known issue for all LLMs, large language models.
So they're saying, hey, the tech just does that sometimes.
Essentially, yes. Which just underscores the immense legal fragility of these generative AI tools that are, you know, prone to hallucinating and generating false, potentially reputation-damaging content.
This whole discussion of regulatory vulnerability, where the tech is just racing ahead of the rules, it leads us pretty neatly to another market being dramatically disrupted by, well, regulatory loopholes: sports betting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating parallel. The disruption here comes from these prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket. They're operating nationwide by basically exploiting a critical loophole.
How does that work? They offer these event contracts.
Yeah, exactly. Which look and feel exactly like sports bets. Will Team A win the game? That kind of thing.
But the regulatory mechanism is the key. They operate under the oversight of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC.
Right. Treating the outcome of a sports event like it's a financial commodity contract.
So they completely bypass the state gaming commissions and all that complex state-by-state licensing that traditional sports books like DraftKings and FanDuel have to deal with.
Precisely. And that loophole just got a huge stamp of legitimacy. The NHL became the first major U.S. pro sports league to actually grant licensing agreements to these startups.
Yeah.
Allowing them to use league trademarks, NHL, Stanley Cup, things like that.
That's massive for them. A huge validation.
Oh, absolutely. And the established sports books, their shares slumped immediately. They, along with state gaming commissions, have already filed legal challenges. They're arguing these prediction markets are just blatantly flouting state laws designed to protect consumers and, importantly, raise tax revenue.
So this legal fight, pitting financial regulation against gaming regulation, it sounds like it could be huge.
The source material suggests it's likely headed for the Supreme Court. It might be the highest stakes legal fight over a regulatory technicality we've seen in years.
That's a really powerful transition point, moving from, you know, regulatory arbitrage in the betting world to a complete regulatory void in an industry involving really profound human emotions, surrogacy. We're shifting now into the domestic sphere, where financial fraud and social stress seem to be compounding these existing crises.
Yeah, this is a truly heartbreaking story. It's about systemic financial abuse in the surrogacy industry, which is, you know, a multi-billion dollar high growth sector expected to grow 15% annually.
And the costs are huge. Intended parents often pay upwards of $150,000 for a surrogate birth. Surrogates themselves might receive $50,000 or more. That's a massive amount of money flowing through these escrow businesses, which are supposed to be safeguarded third parties.
But the critical failure here is systemic. There are basically no federal laws regulating the financial aspects of surrogacy.
None at all.
Effectively none. These escrow businesses are largely unregulated. They often commingle client funds, treating them less like safeguarded accounts and more like, well, their own personal operating accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Even the industry's own best practices group only provides non-binding guidelines, recommending basic bond coverage that's often just not sufficient.
And the case of surrogacy escrow account management, SEAM, is just a spectacular example of this failure.
Absolutely. Up to $16 million just went missing. We hear these stories like Anna Maria Glotzi. She'd used crowdfunding, taken out a second mortgage to pay $55,000 into escrow, only to find her account completely drained.
Devastating. And the allegations against the owner, Dominique Seid, they just underscore the sheer audacity of the alleged fraud.
Right. Seid, who apparently also had a side career as a body rapper named Dom.
You can't make this stuff up.
No. She allegedly transferred millions from client escrow accounts to fund her recording studio, buy real estate, and support her vegan clothing brand, Nikki Green, which ironically sold a $600 vegan leather belt. The commingling was allegedly used to fund this entire extravagant lifestyle.
And the emotional and financial toll on the parents must have been immense.
Unimaginable. Kelly O'Dell and her husband lost $47,000. To make sure they could still pay their surrogate, not jeopardize their baby's future, they had to sell retirement investments. A devastating financial sacrifice, forced purely by a lack of regulation.
And the sources stress this wasn't just an isolated event, right? It's a pattern.
Exactly. The article highlights other recent convictions. Lillian Markowitz embezzled $150,000 for her yoga studio and flotation chambers. Destiny Combs stole $2.7 million to feed an online gambling debt. Daryl Kaufman stole money for Bitcoin. It just reveals this terrifying vulnerability in a highly emotional, high-cost sector.
Okay, shifting gears to a financial pressure point that impacts nearly every American worker, rising health insurance costs.
Yeah, it just keeps going up. For the third consecutive year, the cost of a family plan skyrocketed. It hit just under $27,000 in 2025.
$27,000.
It's like a 6% increase following two prior years of 7% gains. It's significantly outpacing inflation and especially wage growth. It's creating a real financial squeeze for families.
What's driving it? Is it just general healthcare costs?
It's multifaceted. Higher hospital prices, sure. Rising rates of severe conditions like cancer in the working age population. Higher overall healthcare spending. But a major, very topical driver right now is the increased spending on costly new therapies, particularly those GLP-1 weight loss and diabetes drugs.
Like Ozempic and Wegovy.
Exactly. The source material notes that 57% of large firms now cover these drugs in 2025. That's a big jump and a big cost driver.
And this cost is forcing some painful decisions onto employers, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. William Duff Architects, a company mentioned that prides itself on generous coverage, they got hit with a staggering 38% rate increase for their top-tier plan.
38%.
They just couldn't absorb it anymore. They had to shift the burden, requiring employees to pay more for those once generous plans.
And the impact is felt most sharply by small businesses.
Definitely. Over half of small businesses reported a 10% or greater increase this year. And this is leading a growing number of them to just abandon traditional group plans entirely. They're opting instead for things like health reimbursement accounts, which often shift more of the financial risk directly onto the employee.
Meanwhile, the government itself is kind of losing its sight on the economy thanks to this continuing government shutdown.
Yeah, it's what they call a statistical blackout. Because of the shutdown, Federal Reserve officials literally cannot receive official U.S. economic statistics. They're flying blind in that sense.
And that loss of visibility is compounded by another loss, a voluntary loss of private sector data.
That's right. The Fed recently lost access to this incredibly timely, comprehensive, anonymized employment and earnings data from ADP, which covers a huge chunk, 20% of the private workforce.
Why did they lose access?
Apparently, the access was halted shortly after a Fed governor's speech back in August drew public attention to the data sharing arrangement. ADP got spooked, maybe.
And this ADP data is significant because
it's far more granular and real time than the official government stats. Former Fed Chair Jerome Powell actually publicized their use of this data back in 2019. He specifically noted that if they'd had it during the 2008 financial crisis, it could have alerted policymakers to the economic deterioration much sooner than the official figures, which often get revised down weeks or months later.
So the Fed has lost a critical, high-fidelity, real-time gauge of the job market at the exact moment the official channels are completely silent because of political deadlock.
Precisely. The government's ability to navigate the economy is, yeah, essentially flying blind right now.
And that political deadlock, it extends to the fundraising and the sort of ideological health of the minority party, the Democrats. They seem to be facing some critical divisions ahead of the midterms.
The fundraising gap mentioned is staggering. It should be a major red flag for the party. The Republican National Committee, the RNC, holds $86 million cash on hand.
$86 million.
Compared to the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, with just $12 million.
Wow.
That cash deficit is about double what it was back in 2017, the last time the GOP held both the White House and Congress.
And the sources suggest it's not just a lack of small donors, right? Major donors are holding back.
That seems to be a key part of it. Many major Democratic donors, people like John Hines, Rachel Prisker, an heir to the Hyatt fortune, they're actively withholding funds from the National Committee.
Why?
They're worried that the rising tide of progressivism, championed by figures like, say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or the NYC mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani, will actually hurt the party's electability in competitive districts. Pritzker explicitly stated her worry that the party looks like it can't really compete and win elections.
And the New York City mayoral race is serving as kind of a perfect crucible for this ideological fight.
Exactly. You've got the Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani as the frontrunner, facing off against independent Andrew Cuomo and Republican Curtis Sliwa. The conflicts described were sharp, and they really reveal the party's internal tension.
What were the main flashpoints?
Affordable housing was a big one. Mamdani advocates for a rent freeze. Cuomo challenged his lack of executive experience. But crucially, the sources highlight Mamdani's outspoken criticism of Israel. He accused Cuomo of weaponizing the issue to undermine his campaign.
And this tension connects back to a broader critique that's laid out in the source material, something about an identity trap.
Yeah, the argument presented is that some progressive ideas, like Mamdani's proposal to abolish gifted and talented programs in schools, reflect this so-called identity trap.
Meaning what, exactly?
Well, the argument isn't just political, it's strategic. The idea is that this trap sacrifices the perceived well-being of the many in this case. Maybe bright students who need challenging programs to advance an ideological vision of justice for a smaller ideological few.
And the effect is?
Alienation. It potentially alienates the majority of centrist and working class voters, making them feel like maybe their safety or their children's future is being limited to satisfy someone else's politics. And according to this analysis, that strategic divide helps explain the cash hemorrhage the DNC is facing.
Okay, let's shift our focus now to global tensions. The Trump administration seems to be enacting some significant policy shifts regarding the wars in Ukraine and Gaza, moves that, you know, carry some major risks.
Yeah, definitely some big changes reported. On the Ukraine front, the administration has quietly lifted a key restriction. It allows Kyiv to use some long-range missiles supplied by Western allies for attacks deep inside Russia.
Which missiles specifically?
Specifically British-supplied Storm Shadow cruise missiles. These rely on U.S. targeting data to be fully effective, and the authority to actually approve these sensitive strikes was transferred.
From who to who?
From Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth down to General Alexis Grinkiewicz, who's the top U.S. general in Europe.
So taking the decision out of D.C. and putting it closer to the battlefield?
Essentially, yes. It decentralizes the decision-making, moving the power to approve potentially escalatory strikes from Washington to the theater commander. This decision came after President Trump apparently backed off an earlier, even more provocative proposal to send U.S.-made Tomahawk missiles, which have a much greater range, over 1,000 miles.
So we've already seen this policy in action.
Seems so. Ukraine successfully used a storm shadow, according to the report, to strike a Russian plant in Bryansk, a plant that produced explosives and rocket fuel.
And at the same time, the U.S. is hitting Russia financially.
Right. Planning substantial new sanctions, targeting Russia's two biggest oil companies, Lukoil and Rosneft, plus nearly three dozen subsidiaries, basically trying to cut them off from the U.S. financial system.
But there's a contradiction here, isn't there, with the president's own statement?
Yes, that's the confusing part. After the story about lifting restrictions broke, President Trump apparently wrote on Truth Social that the Wall Street Journal story was fake news. He claimed the U.S. has nothing to do with those missiles.
So active policy escalation happening behind the scenes, but public denial.
Exactly. Which creates significant confusion, you'd imagine, for both allies and adversaries.
Okay, turning to the Middle East. The U.S. and Israel are reportedly considering a highly controversial plan for Gaza reconstruction. One that seems to fundamentally change the long-term governance picture there.
Yeah, the proposal is to divide Gaza into separate zones. One controlled by Israel, one by Hamas.
Divide Gaza.
That's the plan being considered. And the really problematic element is that reconstruction funds would only flow to the Israeli-controlled safe side. It's being framed as a temporary stopgap until Hamas is disarmed. Jared Kushner is cited as a driving force, with Vice President J.D. Vance kind of summarizing the thinking.
What are the long-term implications that have people worried?
Arab mediators are apparently alarmed. They argue this formal division could easily lead to permanent Israeli control over a significant portion of the enclave. And consequently, they're unlikely to commit their own troops to police the area under those terms, which really undermines the whole security structure of the plan.
And compounding these geopolitical tensions, there was a ruling from the International Court of Justice, the ICJ.
Yes, a non-binding opinion. But it stated that Israel must allow the UN aid agency, UNWA, to deliver humanitarian aid in Gaza. The ICJ also labeled Israel an occupying power and said Israel failed to substantiate its claims that UNRWA was significantly infiltrated by Hamas.
So that adds significant international legal and political pressure to the situation.
Definitely.
Okay, moving back to domestic economic strategy for a moment. This administration is also expanding its use of federal funding to actually gain equity stakes in critical next-generation technology companies. That feels like a pretty dramatic shift in industrial policy.
It really does signal a significant expansion of the Trump economic intervention strategy. We're seeing several quantum computing companies, IonQ, Rigetti Computing, D-Wave Quantum, are reportedly in talks to give the Commerce Department equity stakes in exchange for federal funding, minimum awards of $10 million each being discussed.
What's the rationale behind the government taking ownership stakes?
The thinking seems to be, since taxpayer money is providing financial support and essentially stamping approval on critical technology that the government itself might rely on, well, the government should share in the upside, share in the profit, maybe even the intellectual property.
And this follows a recent precedent with Intel.
Exactly. Just in August, the government converted nearly $9 billion in grants to Intel into equity, taking an early 10% stake in the chip company. Now, the Commerce Department is apparently aggressively seeking not just equity, but things like warrants, licenses to IP, royalties, revenue sharing, all in exchange for funding. It really feels like a new era of state-backed capitalism taking shape.
From high-tech policy to, well, high ceremony, there's a major, pretty dramatic change happening right at the White House itself. The administration is tearing down the entire East Wing.
That's right. This structure, it's over 100 years old, traditionally hosted the First Lady's offices, visitor entrances, slated for complete demolition.
Why? What are they building instead?
The aim is to clear space for a sprawling new 90,000-square-foot ballroom, capable of seating more than 650 people.
A ballroom. And the cost.
The estimate has ballooned to $300 million, up from $250 million initially, though they say it's being funded by private donations. President Trump defended it, saying the East Wing was a very small building and assuring people the main historic structure won't be touched.
Still, tearing down a 100-year-old part of the White House, that's bound to draw criticism.
Oh, absolutely. The sheer scale of the demolition is guaranteed to add to criticism from Democrats, historians, preservationists, you name it.
Okay, and finally, in counter-narcotics, the U.S. has widened its controversial drug boat strike campaign, escalating tensions with regional allies.
Yeah, the U.S. announced a strike on a suspected drug boat, but this time in the eastern Pacific Ocean. That's a major geographical shift. The previous 7 strikes reported were all confined to the Caribbean.
And the human cost.
2 people were killed in this specific strike, bringing the campaign's announced death toll to 34.
And this widening campaign is happening amid existing tensions.
Yes, particularly with Colombian President Gustavo Petro, who has previously called these strikes atrocities. Expanding into the Pacific signals a significant escalation in policy and a more aggressive application of force against suspected drug smugglers.
All right, let's shift our attention now to a really critical global economic story. The profound political and economic crisis facing Nelson Mandela's party, the African National Congress, in South Africa.
Yeah, the ANC, the party that, you know, delivered the nation from apartheid, is now facing intense public scrutiny. Despite its promise of prosperity, South Africa is currently the world's most unequal society. The gap between rich and poor is actually wider now than it was in 1994.
Wider than in 1994?
Yeah. Unemployment stands at a crippling 43%. GDP growth predicted at just a meager 1.2%. It's a grim picture.
And the core mechanism of this failure seems rooted in a policy that was meant to correct historical injustice. The Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act, or BEE.
That's the tragic irony. BEE was designed to empower poor Black South Africans through things like preferential government contracts and business ownership mandates.
But the reality, according to the critics cited in the sources,
is that BEE has largely fostered corruption and enriched a small elite pool of ANC members. They use this loaded term, tenderpreneurs, to describe those connected to the ANC who've received billions in government tenders.
Tenderpreneurs.
Yeah. And the result is often poor service delivery, inflated costs, and the enrichment of influential party figures, including President Ramaphosa himself, according to these critics.
And this policy failure is actually deterring international investment now.
It seems so. Elon Musk's SpaceX, for example, is reportedly seeking an exemption from a VE rule that would require selling 30% of its local Starlink operation to Black South Africans. The policy, while maybe noble in its original intent, is now seen by critics even some former anti-apartheid activists, as having created a new, politically connected elite who, in their words, have betrayed us.
Wow. Okay, moving from these major policy failures to some individual successes. Let's explore some of these highly relatable personal finance stories. They demonstrate the kind of discipline required to pay off student debt, where the average federal loan balance is around, what, $40,000?
Yeah, about 40K. And these stories are important because they show practical strategies that go beyond just simple budgeting.
Like Lauren Braley. She had $125,000 in debt initially.
Right. And she actively refinanced several times. That alone saved her a substantial $55,000 just in interest. Plus, she used a focused side gig career coaching to generate the final chunk of cash needed for her last $20,000 payment. It shows that multi-pronged approach.
And then there's Christopher Villarreal. Grew up poor, accumulated $46,600 in debt. Paid it off just days before getting laid off. Talk about a close call.
Wow. That really shows the value of eliminating debt when you can.
And what makes his story really stick in your mind is the dedication. He boosted his income by donating blood plasma for $200 a week to help make those payments.
Donating plasma, that's sheer tenacity right there.
The motivations for others were deeply emotional, too. Mia Chloe Bowman, a teacher, paid off $19,000 in 2 years, largely thanks to disciplined saving during the pandemic payment pause.
Ah, yes. The pause was key for many.
And she celebrated by visiting Niagara Falls, a place her late mother had always wanted to see. And Natalie Bartels, she paid off $16,000, partly because she felt, you know, profound embarrassment having debt while her new husband was debt-free.
These anecdotes really highlight a major economic reality, don't they? For those with discipline, that pandemic payment pause acted as a unique kind of forced savings opportunity. The key lesson here, really applicable to any major debt, isn't just cutting costs. It's actively using side incomes, refinancing strategically, and setting these highly personal, emotionally resonant goals to keep the momentum going.
Okay, shifting back to the markets for a moment. We saw a classic example of highly speculative investing, that meme stock frenzy this week, centering on Beyond Meat, a company that, let's face it, has otherwise struggled to really persuade consumers long term.
Oh, yeah. Beyond Meat shares surged as much as 86% in a single day, fueled almost entirely by these meme investors, and then gave back every single one of those gains hours later.
86% up and then back to zero gain. Wild.
Completely wild. Over 2 billion shares traded hands. It made Beyond Meat the second most traded U.S. stock that day, purely based on volatility, not fundamentals.
And the online chatter, like on Wall Street Bets, it provides a real window into that speculative mindset.
It does. The source quoted one post. Wife's boyfriend said, "I'm the only thing that's getting grilled if I lose it all on BYND."
Oh.
It just underscores how, for some traders, the stock market is simply a high-stakes gambling venue, completely disconnected from underlying business fundamentals or long-term value.
All right, before we move into our final synthesis, let's quickly tie up the remaining domestic and global briefs, just to make sure we capture the full breadth of the sources from that day.
Good call. The Chicago Fed reported that economic growth picked up in October, rose above trend compared to a lagging September. They saw easing labor cost pressures, but higher cost pressures from other production inputs. So kind of a mixed signal on inflation there.
Okay. And U.S.-Canada travel, still in a slump.
Yeah. Continues to show weakness, particularly Canadian return trips from the U.S. by car, down 33%. By air, down 17%. Interestingly, trips to Canada by overseas residents climbed 9.2%. Suggests maybe a localized issue with that specific cross-border movement.
We also saw that high-profile and highly contentious federal intervention in New York City, the ICE raid on Canal Street.
Right. Targeting criminal activity related to counterfeit goods. 9 illegal immigrants were arrested. And this operation drew immediate, sharp criticism from local leaders. Mayor Adams, Cuomo, Mamdani all weighed in. There were reports of clashes between protesters and federal agents, creating what was described as a chaotic and, frankly, a frightening experience for bystanders.
A lot of tension there. And on the global stage, any other key briefs?
A few quick ones. North Korea performed its first ballistic missile tests in 5 months, notably just days before President Trump and other leaders were expected to meet in South Korea. Peru's new president, José Jury, declared a state of emergency in the capital, Lima, to try and stem a surge in violence. And tragically, more than 40 people died in a horrific vehicle crash on a highway in western Uganda involving 2 buses.
Awful. Okay, finally, let's touch on a couple of sports highlights, or maybe lowlights in one case.
Yeah, starting with Paris. A devastating security failure reported at the Louvre Museum. thieves made off with a stunning $102 million worth of royal and Napoleonic-era jewelry.
$102 million? How do they manage that at the Louvre?
The thieves were apparently disguised as workers wearing yellow vests. They used an elevator truck to cut into a balcony window of the Galerie d'Apollon. And the failure was shockingly basic. The only surveillance camera near that area was pointed in the wrong direction.
Pointed the wrong way. Unbelievable. Allowing them to just operate with impunity.
Seems like it.
And in baseball. The Dodgers are looking dominant.
Yeah. The Los Angeles Dodgers, leveraging that record payroll, over $350 million, they were reported as being on the precipice of back-to-back World Series titles, looking invincible in the postseason. Their manager even embraced their role as baseball's evil empire.
How so?
He apparently said, before this season started, they said the Dodgers are ruining baseball. Let's get four more wins and really ruin baseball. Leaning into it.
Huh. Okay. And one last sports note from college football.
Right. Texas A&M football. Despite major roster turnover from a previous top recruiting class, they were 7-0, thanks in part to a Swedish tight end, Theo Mellen-Erstrom.
And there's a quirky detail about him.
Yeah, due to his European visa status, he's apparently the only starter on the team not earning NIL money. Name, image, likeness, sponsorship money. Just highlights the complex intersection of college sports, big money, and immigration law these days.
Okay. Now that we've covered the entire breadth of this immense source material, let's try to connect some of the major threads that seem to define this moment, particularly this relentless speed of AI, and maybe the surprising resistance of complex human systems to optimization.
Yeah, I think we can use an editorial concept that was cited in the source material to frame this. The collapse of Wright's Law.
Wright's Law. Remind us.
Traditionally, Wright's Law states that costs fall predictably as production doubles. Basically, learning follows production. You manufacture things, you make mistakes, you improve, things get cheaper over time. It's the learning curve.
Okay. But AI fundamentally breaks that relationship.
That's the argument. Experience no longer needs to follow physical production. Experience can now come before production, through simulation, millions of times. Instantly. So the learning curve doesn't just get steeper, it effectively collapses.
And this explains things like the Tesla earnings drop. They're front-loading all the learning, expecting production gains to arrive almost instantly later.
Exactly. They're investing heavily in that simulated experience. And this has profound implications across the board. Knowledge that once took decades of human trial and error can potentially emerge in weeks. Supply chains could become these adaptive organisms. Traditional ownership models, like having vast fleets of trucks or huge warehouses, could be replaced by dynamic, instant orchestration based on data.
So the winners in this new economy are?
The sources state it's those who control the richest data streams and can deploy these AI savants, highly specialized systems that blend immense computational power with deep industry insight.
And this shift from just experimenting with AI to large-scale adoption, we're already seeing it reflected in corporate earnings, like IBM.
Yeah, IBM's revenue was up 9% in the third quarter mentioned in the report.
And that growth was driven by AI adoption.
Heavily boosted by their consulting business, which was up 3%. And crucially, their CFO noted that clients are now rapidly moving beyond just experimenting with AI to actively scaling it within their entire businesses.
Mm-hmm.
About 80% of IBM's 300 AI clients in the past two quarters were actually new clients.
Mm-hmm.
That suggests this broad adoption phase is really accelerating dramatically.
Okay, so on one hand, you have this commercial world becoming hyper-optimized, driven by 100-hour work weeks, collapsing learning curves, moving it to the speed of computation. We're just rushing towards hyper-efficiency.
Right.
And yet, simultaneously, we see these chronic, deep-seated human problems that seem fundamentally resistant to any kind of optimization or technological solution.
Exactly.
You've got political divisions causing government shutdowns, paralyzing economic visibility for the Fed. You have the systemic corruption apparently undermining South Africa's foundational economic policies, enriching tenderpreneurs instead of empowering the poor. You see chaotic pushback-fueled human clashes during events like that NYC ICE raid. These aren't problems that seem solvable by just throwing more computing power at them.
And the sources make a crucial observation here. These systems, these optimized systems, risk collapsing into fragility because of that very hyper-optimization. So our final question for you, the listener, is really this. Given the reality of the collapsing learning curve in technology and this chronic resistance of human politics and social systems to optimization, are certain complex human problems fundamentally insoluble by AI? And maybe more importantly, what happens to the human element, things like democratic accountability, the ethical safeguards we talked about with the OpenAI case, when the world's commercial and governmental arteries become these hyper-optimized, fragile black boxes?
It really feels like a world changing faster than our ability to safely govern it. We want to thank you for sharing your sources with us and letting us dive into this really complex terrain with you today.
Always a pleasure. We hope this deep dive provides some of the context and clarity needed to navigate what was clearly an incredibly complex week captured in that day's journal.